This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Part of the reason that I wanted to do the research in the way that I did, where I actually did the thing with my own hands, I would notice like, oh, the pink of the sunset is a little bit different today, or this flower is budding that wasn't yesterday. That was the point, but nobody told me that was the point.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Karen Hahn.
And I'm your other host, June Thomas.
Hi, June.
Hey, Karen.
So who did you talk to this week?
So the voice we heard at the beginning of the show belongs to Hannah Kirshner. She's the author of Water, Wood and Wild Things, Learning Craft and Cultivation in a Japanese Mountain Town. And the book is a really engaging account of the time Hannah spent in the rural Japanese town of Yamanaka, working alongside various artisans and learning from them. It's an appreciation of traditional arts like sake brewing, wood turning, and duck hunting, to name just three, and a meditation on why people choose to do those things.
Oh, wow. Well, I can't wait to hear the interview, and I can't wait to hear the Slate Plus segment this week either. What did you guys talk about?
So I asked Hannah if there was one of the 10 or so different fields that she learned about that she really connected with. And we talked about the chapter that really stuck with me, which was when she cultivated rice naturally using hand tools and without any agricultural chemicals.
Wow.
And how that changed the way she eats and she appreciates her food.
That's incredible. So listeners, if you haven't already, why not join Slate Plus and listen to this fascinating new segment? As a member, you'll get no ads on any of our podcasts, unlimited reading on the Slate site, and member exclusive episodes and segments from us and other shows like the Culture Gab Fest and The Waves. To learn more about becoming a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/workingplus. Okay, let's hear June's conversation with Hannah Kirshner.
Hannah Kirshner, I am delighted to speak with you today because I absolutely loved your book, Water, Wood and Wild Things, Learning Craft and Cultivation in a Japanese Mountain Town. Let's begin with you telling our listeners what the book is about.
Well, it's about the town of Yamanaka Onsen, which is in Ishikawa Prefecture in Japan. So it's this little mountain hot spring town. And I spent a few years there following the work of the people literally making the culture of the town. So artisans and artists and farmers and hunters and foragers. And with each person, I spent a few months or even a few years apprenticing to them or tagging along, learning from them to see how they make the things that they do and also why and their relationship to work and tradition and how all these things weave together into the culture of the town and the community too.
Yeah. The first time I went to Japan, I wrote a series for Slate. It was about artisans. It was about shokunin. There were in the Tokyo area, so quite different from this countryside place that you were based in. But I think the series was called Doing Things the Hard Way.
I want to go back and read that.
Because a lot of the time, like, it just seems like there are so much easier ways of doing this thing. And it's not just like there's this cheap, nasty way, and then there's this more traditional way. There's like really, really, really hard as you can possibly make it. And that's kind of how certain kinds of Japanese craftspeople tend to work. And a lot of the people, not all of them necessarily, but a lot of the people you write about have that approach to life, it seems to me.
It was really fascinating to see. I mean, if you are choosing to do something the hard way or entirely by hand, like why and what's the point? What do you get out of that? And see the relationship that people have with their work through that. But also, like, I was very fascinated with, in the sake brewery where I worked in particular, and in other sake breweries I visited, like, there's this combination of really old traditional tools and really new modern tools, and how it wasn't just choosing one or the other, but these very deliberate choices about, like, well, the way we've been doing this for centuries works just fine, so why change it? Or, well, this area, you know what? It would really be nice to make it a little easier. Or this new technology, like, just really does do a better job. So, yeah. Like, you know, not just wholesale one or the other, old traditional way or new technological way, but, like, how people are being very deliberate about those choices.
Yeah. And I was very curious about how you came to write the book. And I should say that the reason I'm asking is that one of the things that became clear to me as I was reading it is that it's not a stunt book. You know, this, when by a stunt book, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but mm-hmm. it is a thing, you know, that's where people say, I did X so that I could write a book about it. And your book did not read that way at all. So I'm curious, did you always intend for your time in Japan to be the basis of a book and these things that you were studying with these very experienced craftsmen and creators?
Well, I knew I wanted to write a book, but I thought I wanted to write probably a cookbook or a book about Japanese food. And basically, I first went to Japan when I was straight out of college and spent a month with a bunch of bike messengers in a bike messenger house in Kyoto, and stayed friends with those guys. And years later, one of them introduced me to the owner of a small sake bar in this town, Yamanaka Onsen. So he actually asked me if I would host this guy. He said, oh, my friend who owns the sake bar, he really wants to come to New York, and could you host him? And I'm like, sure. I mean, you hosted me. I didn't even know you, and you hosted me in your house. And I was like this kid traveling on a month with only $500. And like, yeah, of course I'll host your friend. Meanwhile, he tells the bar owner, my friends in New York really want to meet you. Can you go visit them? Luckily, this worked out, and it ended up leading then to me going and apprenticing in his bar in Yamanaka. And I was just thinking at the time, like, well, this will be it's such a rare and unusual opportunity, and I don't know what doors it's going to open, but it's going to open doors, and maybe this will tell me, like, what kind of cookbook I'd want to write. I mean, sake is part of the food culture of Japan, so learning about sake could lead me somewhere. But what it led to, instead of a cookbook, you know, I as I said, like, I met all these different people making the town's culture. Like, a bar can be sort of a community hub. And so I met this guy who was, like, making charcoal in his village, where that used to be the main industry, and now he's the only person living in that outer village of Yamanaka. I met all these incredible wood turners and lacquer craftspeople. And I realized the book I wanted to write was, like, how do all these things, if you think about a Japanese meal, like, how do all these things come to the table? And how were they made? And what are the stories behind them? And who are the people making them?
Yeah. And before we go further, since you mentioned, you know, Yamanaka is a place that used to have X, that used to have Y, mm-hmm. you know, this is a mountain town. It's very far from Tokyo. It's very far from, I think, how most people picture Japan. Can you explain what it's like to be in Japan's deep countryside? Can you describe Yamanaka?
Yeah. I mean, for me, the first thing I noticed was just in the geography and the landscape, like the striking similarities to the Pacific Northwest where I'm from. So there's all these tree plantations of sugi, which usually gets translated as cedar, but it's a kind of cypress, actually. So there's these evergreen trees, and then there's just, like, moss and ferns. It's so green. It's very humid all year round, so it's cold and wet in the winter and really humid and muggy in the summer. But the town itself is very charming, and there's a real sense of just kind of, like, everybody knows each other. It is a small community. And because it's a hot spring town, it has an onsen. It's been a tourist destination for over 1,000 years. So
a thousand years.
It hasn't been, it's not spoiled by that tourism somehow. This town's not jaded. Instead, I think it's sort of had this effect of there being cultural exchange, even though it's this really tiny place. It used to be somewhere that the merchant sailors would come in on their break and stay there. It used to be a sort of a religious pilgrimage for the hot springs, too. And so there's always been people coming and going from other places. And, you know, it supports the craft industry because there's people coming who want to buy souvenirs. So that's how it ended up being this wood turning town, too, is that the wood turners could sell their wares as souvenirs. And their materials are right there in the mm-hmm. forest. So. Mm-hmm.
So, Hannah, what is wood turning?
So it is using a sharp tool to shape a piece of wood that is spinning on a lathe. In Yamanaka, you're mostly making cups or bowls and carving the shape out as this hunk of wood spins very fast. You have pedals to control it, kind of like, I mean, to me, I thought of like a sewing machine. But Yamanaka has its own distinct style of lathe, and all the craftsmen make their own tools to use with this kind of lathe.
To the extent that this kind of town is written about in the, let's just say, the Western media, it's as places that are dying or certainly shrinking, disappearing. All of those words seem very negative, but it's also just kind of reality. Even the crafts that you're talking about, you know, maybe the last person doing it, maybe they're even the people that you write about are doing it for the last time. How did you approach that question of the decline in a place that you clearly love so much and write about so lovingly and full of affection for, while kind of dealing with that? Is it even going to be there?
That's certainly a reality, that small towns in Japan are losing population and have been for a long time, that, you know, the young people go to the cities because that's where there's more opportunity, and people don't want the hard life of being a farmer or working with their hands necessarily. But I noticed right away, too, that there were young people moving there because they were interested in that kind of life. So, yeah, like Mika Horie, the paper maker and photographer that I write about, she moved from Kyoto to Yamanaka because she could harvest the materials for her paper herself, make her paper, and then she takes photographs of the landscape and makes cyanotypes on her handmade paper. You know, and then some of the people farming also left other work and moved there because that they wanted to have a life where they were more connected to the source of their food. And then like Takehito Nakashima, the wood turner that I write about, he grew up there and is practicing this very traditional craft of wood turning, but at the same time, he's both an artisan and an artist and really trying to sustain a tradition. But at the same time, like he said to me, like, well, you know, tradition's not just something in the past, it's something that we're making. So he says, you know, I hope that I'm making things that 100 years from now people will say are traditional.
Yeah. So when you were in Yamanaka and you were, again, I don't want to harp on this, but were you conscious of kind of helping these traditions to survive through your book and through your writing? Was that like part of your motivations for writing the book?
I mean, a little bit. It sort of felt like there are all these things that either people don't know about, or if they've been written about in English, they're just, it's wrong. Like I read some articles about the duck hunters that I followed, that like even the first day I spent with them, I was like, wait a minute, whoever wrote that story like didn't get this quite right. So I definitely felt, because of that, like a real responsibility to try to represent people and their work as like honestly and accurately as possible, and really take the time to learn in depth about what they were doing. And I don't know. I don't think it's really like my place to be like, oh, we should save these crafts. I mean, so yeah, I wanted to honor and document these crafts, these, and it's not just crafts, but the work that people are doing, because it's beautiful, it's meaningful, it's connected to history in all sorts of fascinating ways too. But I think especially as a woman, I have a complicated relationship to tradition. I mean, there are a lot of these traditions, you know, used to exclude women or I mean, just like when we talk about traditional culture, that often excludes a lot of people. And so I really wondered, like, how can we save the beautiful parts of a tradition while also making it fit with like our contemporary values? And really every single person that I wrote about answered that in some different way through their life and work.
Yeah. And of course, that is a good opportunity to bring up something that is very, you know, feels very salient. You know, I've spent time in Japan. I'm very aware that a lot of Japanese people have a kind of fascination with foreigners, or specifically non-Asian foreigners. Or people who are visibly not Japanese, maybe. And you must have been super aware of that, hyper aware of that when you were in Yamanaka.
Especially in a small town.
Yeah. And being a woman doing those things. So how did you negotiate that, those feelings?
You know, it was both a challenge and an advantage. There's definitely like, you know, privileges afforded because of that difference that especially white American foreigners get. And also being treated as a perpetual guest, which can be really annoying, but it also can mean that you're forgiven for all sorts of social faux pas, or that people, you know, want to show off to you or share with you. So it definitely took time to sort of get past that in my relationships with people. And yeah, and it was something I felt like I had to negotiate in like how I wrote also.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, because, you know, you're being reminded constantly, I guess, of your status as an outsider, and part of writing, especially something like this where you're writing about an experience, you have to be a little bit of an outsider to do that kind of writing. Like, do you think in some way it helped?
Oh yeah, it did help in some ways, because yeah, people were a little bit more willing to like share or open up, but sometimes it was the opposite. I mean, rural Japan, and I think this is kind of true of rural places in a lot of the world, can be very insular. And so much is based on trust and relationships. And so if you're an outsider, a lot's just like closed off to you. And like my friend who's from Kyoto, actually the bike messenger who first connected me with Yamanaka, he works in the town now too. And like now that I've been living there for a few years, he's like, oh, I'm more of a foreigner here than you are, Hannah. So like somebody from just even the next town over can be considered a foreigner. Somebody from the big city is really a foreigner. So, but there's that flip side to that, is that once you're in, suddenly all these doors open. So the sake brewery I worked in, they had not had a woman or a foreigner in 14 generations of being in business. Not so much that they were opposed to it, that just hadn't been done. And it's a small brewery, so they don't really like give tours or anything like that. So even just to get to go look inside like took a lot of convincing. But the reason that he finally decided to let me work there was because the woodturner Nakashima, who's his friend, who I'd already, you know, worked with, he said, oh, Hannah's fine, she's good, you should let her. And so a lot of things worked like that too. So, you know, two sides to the same coin.
We'll be back with more of June's conversation with Hannah Kirshner.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, working listeners. We want to hear from you. Whether it's to ask us for advice on a creative problem, tell us a guest you'd like to hear on the show, or share your own creative triumphs, drop us a line at working@slate.com or give us a ring at 304-933-WORK. And if you're enjoying this episode, don't forget to subscribe to Working wherever you get your podcasts. Now let's return to June's conversation with Hannah Kirshner.
One of the things I was very aware of as somebody who is neither outdoorsy nor strong nor kind of good with my hands in a certain sense was that a lot of the things that you were doing were like really hard labor. And I just kind of wondered, like, I can only imagine you going home and just like passing out. And yet I imagine you kind of had to, you know, make notes, start writing. How did you combine just backbreaking physical labor with writing?
Yeah, I was exhausted and I was trying to write this book at the same time, especially the first few chapters I wrote before finishing the book proposal. And there were some things that I'd sort of had in process. But once the book was under contract, I had a year, which stretched to 18 months, but, you know, a year and a half to get it done. So I was doing these experiences. There were sort of three parts to the research. There were the experiences. There was, like, book research, which I ended up hiring a friend to be my assistant with that. And then there was also interviews with the people, like, once I finished the experiences. But I always had like a little Muji pocket notebook in my pocket at all times. So I took a lot of notes just while I was doing things, while I was talking to people. If somebody said something amazing, jotting it down. And, you know, just details of like the weather and how something smells and like little just visual things that I noticed. And then I had journals all over my house, so like in every room of the house, so I couldn't be lazy.
Wow.
At some point every day in one of those journals, I would write more about, you know, whatever experiences were I thought might become part of the book. And then the real writing, the writing of the chapters, I guess I did on the off days when I wasn't out following boar hunters through the snow or lifting, you know, huge bags of rice in the sake brewery. It was exhausting, though. I seriously don't know how I did it, because now just like more normal things exhaust me. And I guess it was just the excitement and an energy of like having those opportunities as well as the opportunity to write about them.
Yeah. Wow. You mentioned that you hired someone to help you with the research. Can you say more about that? Why you did that and what kind of research help you sought out?
Yeah, well, I knew I wanted to include like some history, and also there are just, I love like having really precise details. Like if I talk about a volcano that's old, like how many years old is it? Or if I say like rural towns are losing population, well, it's nice to have like some data to back that up. And my Japanese is conversational. It's probably worse than conversational when I started. I'm not fluent and I'm not literate. I mean, I can read a menu, but I can't read a textbook. So, and then I started coming across all these books that were like a local history of one of the outer villages of Yamanaka, or like from the duck pond, like a history of the duck pond, or a cookbook that was all about just that region's cuisine. And it would have just been such a shame not to draw on those resources. So I didn't want my lack of language ability to get in the way of that. So I started talking to a friend of mine who was grew up in the area, now lives in Tokyo. He studied anthropology, but was working for like a tech company. And I was like, I don't know, do you know anybody? Maybe they could just like translate sections of books for me. And he's like, I don't know, like my English isn't really good enough. Maybe I know somebody. But then I ended up working with this friend. So he had actually, his thesis had been on the woodworkers, the woodturners of Yamanaka, and he grew up there. So he just had such an understanding of the area. And it was really nice to work with somebody who was a good researcher as opposed to like had perfect English. I mean, actually his English is very good, but we just kind of worked out a system where I would send him books and things that I was finding. He would go to libraries in Tokyo where he had access to documents and things that I didn't, like old newspapers and things. And I'd send him a list of questions for each chapter and he'd give me short answers. And then I'd say, oh, that's interesting. Can you tell me more about that? And we just kind of figured out as we went how to go back and forth.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're being a little bit modest about your Japanese, but, you know, it was very clear that even if you had been super fluent, these are very specific, you know, I'm sure that whatever vocabulary there is in, you know, the several different things that you did, you know, you not only have to be fluent in Japanese, but also be fluent in, you know, wood turning or rice growing. And
well, that was the other funny thing is because I learned about woodworking in Japanese, so I didn't actually know the correct terms for these things in English. So then once I wrote it in English, then I had to go find some American woodturners and be like, can you read this and tell me if I'm like calling these tools the right things or like if this sounds okay to a woodworker?
Wow. Yeah. So, wow. That's crazy. But I was very struck by like the way that the learning process, as you described it, was often kind of wordless for everyone,
yeah.
Not just for you, but that was kind of the nature of the apprenticeship system that everyone who learned those trades or crafts or skills knew.
Yeah, definitely. With the more traditional ways of teaching craft, it's not very verbal. There's not a lot of explanation. You're meant to just watch the master and see what they do and sort of do busy work until you figure it out. Some of my experiences were a little bit different because like with the woodturner, like he was actually teaching me a lesson. But yeah, a lot of it was like whether you're fluent in Japanese or not, like the language is not how a lot of the information is being conveyed.
So I'm conscious that there's no formal apprenticeship in writing, but I don't know if you were conscious of how learning in this way, in this kind of wordless way, did that kind of trickle down into the way you wrote about it? Because you weren't just kind of translating what people had said to you. You had to convey this experience that you had with people.
Part of the reason that I wanted to do the research in the way that I did, where I spent so much time with people, where I actually did the thing, whatever it was, with my own hands, is because then I get to learn so much that somebody would probably never tell me in an interview. I could interview them over and over and over again, and they might not articulate that. Just being in the space, seeing how they work, seeing how they interact with their colleagues or their friends. And like, especially with the duck hunters, this was really poignant. Like, they go out there every evening, right as the ducks are leaving the pond from November to February, and they're catching ducks with this essentially a net on this like Y-shaped frame that they toss into the air right when the ducks fly over, and the duck, you know, they have to intersect perfectly with the duck so that then the duck flies into the net and falls to the ground and is stunned. And it's a really inefficient way to catch ducks. That's clearly not the point. It's a skill. It's a sport, really, more than like a way of gathering food, although I guess in some ways it used to be. But sitting out there with them day after day, like I would notice like, oh, the pink of the sunset is a little bit different today, or this flower is budding that wasn't yesterday. Oh, and now today it's blooming. Like just these details of the landscape or connecting with like, oh, I can feel the winds coming from this direction, so that means the ducks are going to behave in this way today. That was the point. But nobody told me that was the point. Like, I had to go out there day after day after day to myself to feel that.
Totally. I want to go back to, you know, you when right at the beginning you were saying how you had originally thought maybe you would do a cookbook. I don't think we really kind of explored what your connection with food was at that point.
Sure. I mean, my connection with food is just first and foremost that I love to eat and I love to cook. And ever since I was a kid, like, I would make up recipes and throw dinner parties, and I thought that I wanted to do something with food, but I had an aunt who was a chef and then left that because it's such a hard life, and I think I knew pretty early on that I didn't need to spend the rest of my life in a kitchen. I have such admiration for people who do, but I didn't want to, and so I eventually found my way to recipe development and testing and food styling, which I have an art background. I actually studied art, so food styling was this great intersection of visual skills and cooking skills.
And you put recipes after every section of the book. Did you kind of expect people to make the things that you had kind of told them how to make?
Yes and no. The recipes are there partly because that's just my way of relating to and experiencing the world and what I notice and tune into. And it's sort of another layer of storytelling, a way to sort of tell a little anecdote at the end of each chapter that doesn't necessarily fit into the main chapter. But I think the recipes function in two ways. Like, some of them are there so that readers can experience a little bit of Yamanaka themselves. Like, maybe you can't travel there, but you can make this candy or you can make this fried chicken. But others are really more to document. Like, I find it sort of frustrating when I can't find information about these very local foods that, because I think they don't get written about because, oh, well, you can't find that ingredient anywhere, so nobody writes the recipe in English or shares it outside of their community. And it's still interesting to know how something's made. And maybe if you're lucky and you come across that ingredient, then you'll know what to do with it. But yeah, it was as much about like archiving and documenting a recipe as it was. I mean, I don't think many people are going to be going out foraging for wasabi leaves, although you can mail order them in the U.S. But
the recipe that I don't really cook anyway, but there's a recipe that involved boar that, you know, I wanted to eat it. I don't think I want to make it because it's way beyond my skill level, but it was like an adventure just reading that recipe.
I'm glad you felt that way, that it was an adventure. But actually, that one's not that hard. It's just a stew. It's got a lot of ingredients, but it's just a stew. You just throw everything in there and keep cooking it for a long time.
Well, yeah, but you forget in the first part, first catch your wild boar, you know?
Like, yeah, well, yeah. No. Yeah, although we have an invasive wild boar problem in parts of the U.S., so.
20 or 30 feral ones, right?
Yeah.
So, one of the reasons I asked about the recipes was, and maybe this is fanciful and weird, but there's an endless fascination with Julia Child. There's a great new HBO Max series that's currently airing, who brought, in a way, French cooking to America. And your book reminded me of some aspects of her first project, The Art of French Cooking. This is the art of traditional Japanese life. This food represents traditional Japan. Did you take inspiration, maybe not exactly from Julia Child, but for anywhere or anyone else when you were kind of conceiving of and writing Water, Wood and Wild Things?
I mean, that's incredibly flattering to be compared at all to Julia Child. I think when it comes to really like documenting Japanese food, that there are other people that have done that really well already. Like Elizabeth Ando's work is incredible. But I'm sure, I mean, I've just consumed so many of those books, like Anything and Everything by M.F.K. Fisher. And I'm sure that those things seeped in there, if not intentionally. I was also thinking about like travelogues and some of these old travelogues about Japan, which a lot of them are really quite offensive if you look at them now. But thinking about like what would a newer version of that form look like. And the illustrations kind of reference that a little bit too. Like, I have these pen and ink drawings that a little bit have that feel of like the old travelogues.
Yeah. My last question is, you know, the paperback version of the book has just been released, but the hardback came out last year. Were there any surprises for you about the way that the book was received?
Well, Unfortunately, most people in Yamanaka can't read it because it's in English. A few did, and I was really touched that they felt that they were well represented because, I mean, you know, it's not an expose. I wasn't like telling all the dirty secrets of everybody, but I tried to have an honest representation, which was not always completely flattering. And so that was neat to see that people were so happy about seeing themselves in the pages. And it's just a lot of people have told me, like American readers have told me that they find it very soothing, which I didn't know that I'd written a soothing book, but I think there's a lot about being in Yamanaka and that landscape and the pace of life that I find very soothing. So it's nice to see that that comes across.
Hannah Kirshner, thank you so much for talking with us on Working and for writing your book, Water, Wood, and Wild Things.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to get to talk to you.
I found this interview really fascinating because this approach, someone not of a culture writing about that culture as an expert, especially with the kind of lack of language ability that Hannah mentions, is a really fraught topic. I'm not saying that there's just one answer to this question, but for you as an admirer of Kirshner's, what do you think makes the difference between a sort of appropriation and appreciation?
Karen, I'm so glad that you asked this question first because it really is the big one that's hovering over any project like this. Is this writer exploiting someone else's culture and traditions? And I have to say, despite being really interested in traditional Japanese arts and crafts, I did not read this book when it first came out because I was afraid it might be appropriative, if that's a word. To my great relief, I did not experience it that way at all. And some of the reasons I think that the book comes across as a very loving appreciation are, first of all, she put in the work, like literally, she sweated in the sake brewery. She toiled under the sun and in the rain and among the bugs to grow rice. You know, she put her fingers at risk to turn wood. She wasn't sitting watching someone do this stuff. She was toiling alongside them. She also put in the time. Like, if you are writing a travel story, which is a genre I've done quite a bit of, no matter how much preparation you do, and I hope I always put in more than I had to, you're still parachuting in to take a snapshot. And this book isn't a snapshot. It's a beautifully complex portrait of a town and its history. And I also think she handled her own role in the story really well. Like, she's definitely a character in this book. It's about her experiences. But at the same time, if we continue with the slightly strained analogy of the book being a painting of Yamanaka, she's not the person who's rendered in most detail. The people who live and work there are beautifully filled out because they're the ones that matter. They're the reasons that she's there. And she never loses sight of who or what is important in this book. And finally, there's none of that the Japanese are like this stuff or like lazy analogies to American institutions or ways of doing things. Both sins that I've committed in my writing about Japan, I must confess.
I'm really interested to hear that you said you were initially kind of apprehensive about reading this book. What made you actually decide to take a look at it?
Honestly, it was that it sounded like it would be a great book for working because it's about work. So it's kind of, you know, it's one of those, and that's not all. There's another level of work. And, you know, ultimately, I am just very interested in Japan. And actually, there's one other thing that just crossed my mind, which is that my partner read it, who has spent a lot more time in Japan than me and who speaks Japanese very well. And it's kind of hard to impress her with books about Japan. And this one did. So I thought, oh, you know what? I should give it a chance. And I'm really glad that I did.
One of the other things that I appreciated in your discussion with Hannah was the fact that being basically a white outsider is usually something of an advantage because there's still this fascination with Westerners, specifically white Westerners, that often doesn't extend to foreigners with darker skin tones. I guess this isn't really necessarily a question for you specifically, but it's just something that I know is sometimes a part of my mental gymnastics as a journalist.
Totally. I mean, the way we are perceived by others is something we have to work with because we usually can't change it or even truly know it. You know, our perceived race and gender and class affect every interaction we have in the world, including the ones that happen as part of our jobs. And as journalists, this often plays out in the way that someone we're trying to get information from responds mm-hmm. to us. And, you know, there's a school of journalism that says the reporter should be as neutral as possible so that they don't become part of the story. You know, they should sort of disappear into the background. You know, maybe. I'm not totally sold on that. But even if it were true, I don't think that that means that we all have to behave like cishet white guys, because that isn't my definition of neutral. And, you know, not so much maybe for the kind of conversational podcast that we do, but in a setting where I'm trying to get a source to feel like they can share information with me, I do often notice myself like trying to be extra charming or super fun. Mm-hmm. And on some level, I think that's because some people who don't know any lesbians of a certain age kind of have the idea that we're all like uptight joke police, more earnest than thou types, you know. So I'm trying to counter that like subliminally or something. And, you know, it is not even slightly pleasant to try to imagine what negative stereotypes people are associating you with. So mm-hmm. I'll be maybe a little bit of a Pollyanna and say that there are also ways that this can be a benefit. Like Hannah Kirshner, yes, was the only non-Japanese person doing these things in Yamanaka, but she had really significant things in common with the other people who were drawn there by their interest in these crafts and traditions. And, you know, there are definitely occasions when your identity can create a deeper connection with your source. You know, their mother is a lesbian or their partner is an immigrant. You both like manga, whatever it might be. It can also work in your favor.
Mm-hmm. Sort of on that note, I wanted to talk about building trust with a subject. How do you do that? Because it's often very difficult to do. And then on top of that, extremely easy to break that trust.
No, it totally is. And it's something that you have to negotiate anew every single time you talk to someone. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm established now, everybody knows. No, it mm-hmm. doesn't work like that. And I also understand why people are wary of speaking to journalists or writers. We ask a lot of them. We're often asking them to share something it would be, let's just say, convenient to keep quiet about. And so I think ultimately you just have to be as honest as possible. Like one thing that often happens, I find, before people will talk to you, they'll say, well, what's your angle going to be? And, you know, like most writers, I imagine, I don't think I ever know the answer to that question until I've written the story and it's gone through editing. And I never want people to think, well, she told me it was going to be, and then, mm-hmm. so, you know, not making promises that you can't keep. And also something that Hannah mentioned, which is keeping your notebook or your recording device quite visible. I think mm-hmm. it's really good to remind people why you're there.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to talk about something that you cover, which is the experience of working with a research assistant, partially because I recently did it for the first time and almost felt kind of nervous about it. I'm so used to working by myself as a journalist and a writer. And granted, Hannah's experience seems to have mostly been because of the language barrier and needing someone to translate. Mm-hmm. But how do you learn to let someone into your project?
I also have really limited experience of this. I'd say probably like the closest analog for me has been working with a fixer. For a couple of stories I've written about Japan, I had people help me with logistics and also serve as an interpreter. And it was just very clear that it was necessary. You know, my Japanese is very rudimentary. And even though my partner's is very good, you know, between the time difference when it comes to setting things up and jet lag when you get there, it just feels like working with someone would just make things go much smoother. I have to say, mm-hmm. though, I've never just hired someone cold. I've always been able to kind of work with people that I already had a certain connection with. But one thing specifically about language, I think a journalistic setting is perhaps the only time when I really want to communicate in English, if at all possible. And even when I speak the language well, I want any quotes to be in the subject's language, not my translation. Like, I've interviewed Pedro Almodovar a few times, and he tends to switch between English and Spanish. So even though I understand his Spanish, I prefer to have an official English version to quote from. And he's usually accompanied by an amazing interpreter who is actually a woman who's a very eminent scholar and professor. So it's very helpful.
Wow.
Do you think, like, you learned anything from that process of working with a research assistant for the first time? Do you think it'll going to be easier next time around?
I think I would have a better idea of it next time, because in this particular instance, my research assistant was brought in pretty late in the process, and also someone who was found by my editor and not by me. I had no personal connection to this person before I started working with them in that capacity. And I feel like it's partially just sort of feeling still kind of young or green, and that I didn't have the authority to tell someone what to do in order to help me. Like, and it also sort of feels like this is technically all stuff that I could do. It wasn't like translating where I really needed someone to do that for me. And it was sort of like, oh, like, I could just do it. Like, why am I burdening someone else? But I feel like maybe if I had to have that experience again, I would take a little more initiative or be a little more certain, or try to be a little more certain in myself in asking for things from them.
Yeah.
I found Hannah's note about making sure that a proper portrait of the people she was writing about involved not always being totally flattering, which feels like an incredibly anxiety-inducing task. It's something that I feel like comes up a lot in contemporary, like, profile writing especially, where obviously, hopefully, you're not setting out just to write a puff piece, but at the same time, how do you make sure that you're not burning that bridge?
Yeah, for sure. It's hard to tell the truth as you see it and then have everyone you write about be completely happy. And it's probably also that's not the goal. And it's not just about burning bridges. It's that nowadays, it's super easy for the people you write about to find that writing and respond, whether that's to be angry or to suggest you got some things wrong, or, you know, to be super happy. Like, I think travel writing, especially however you define it, it used to be something that you could just, like, leave and the people would never know what you wrote. It's more in the open these days, and I think that's for the good. I think, too, that the situation that Hannah Kirshner was in, where she has made a commitment to the town that she was writing about and she still spends half of her year there, like, that's more likely, first of all, to produce a nuanced, accurate picture. And it also is more incentive to be sure you've gotten things right, because you're going to be there again.
Definitely. You have to see those people again.
Exactly.
And so I have one final question from your conversation with Hannah, which is, do you think that you could catch a wild boar?
I'm absolutely positive that I could not. I bet you could, though.
That's extremely kind of you to say, because I honestly think you could do it, too.
Oof. Yeah, I have to tell you, that's one of the few Japanese words that I know. Inoshishi, that's a wild boar.
Oh.
Because it's one of the 12 zodiac years, so it's easier to remember.
Oh, well, you learn something new every day. Well, listeners, we hope you've enjoyed the show. And if you have, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and then you will never miss an episode. And just a reminder that by joining Slate Plus, you'll get ad-free podcasts, extra segments on shows like The Waves and Culture Gabfest, and you'll never hit a paywall on the Slate site. To learn more, go to slate.com/workingplus.
Thanks to Hannah Kirshner and to our stupendous producer, Cameron Drews. We'll be back next week with Isaac's conversation with theatre director Owoye Timpo and dramaturg Arminda Thomas. Until then, get back to work!